we've considered the following situation, right? So let's say we have a block band. So let's say this is my quasi-momentum space, and then I put a particle in some point in the quasi-momentum space, and then I adiabatically move it around some contour. Okay, so then we've established that during this motion, the particle picks up an additional geometrical phase, which depends only on the geometry of this path, but not on the pace at which you are moving along this trajectory. And so, and this geometrical phase, so phi geometrical, is given by the following integral along the path. Right, so k's are vectors here, so you should understand it as a line integral. And psi k's are the Bloch wave functions for a given quasi-momentum. So let us ask the following question. So is this quantity gauge invariant? Because when I'm finding my Bloch wave functions, right, I can only find them up to some phase. So I can always redefine my Bloch wave functions as follows, by multiplying them by some phase zeta, which depends on the momentum. Right, so of course, if indeed this geometrical phase is a physically important quantity, right, it must be gauge invariant. So let's check that it is. So but first, for the future convenience, let's introduce the following notation. So let's introduce a vector field A, which is defined at every point in the quasi-momentum space and which is given by essentially this term here. Okay, so this field is called Beres connection. And then I can represent this Beres phase as a line integral of this field along the path. Okay, so this Beres connection is really in some way similar to the electromagnetic vector potential, right? So that's why when you change the phase of the wave functions, this Beres connection is going to change as well. Okay, so we can find quite easily how it changes. So it's quite similar to the electromagnetic field. So under gauge transformation, Beres connection just acquires a term which is derivative of this gauge phase. Okay, so then you see that if I consider some path, right? So let me for a second consider a path which is not closed, which starts at some point 1 and goes to point 2. Okay, then you will see that the geometrical phase for this path transforms like that, right? So it becomes, so let's say for a given gauge it was line integral like this, and then when the Beres connection changes, right, I get this extra term, and I can integrate it along the path, and what I'm gonna get would be the following. Right, so I got this extra term, which is the difference of the phases of the gauge phases at point 2 and point 1. So clearly, if we consider a path which is not closed, right, this quantity is not gauge invariant. So it's gauge dependent and not physical. But if I now consider situation when the path is closed, right, and point 2 equal to point 1, then I know that physically these points are the same, right? And therefore, when I do this gauge transformation, zeta of 2 should be equal to zeta of 1, right? Maybe plus some integer multiple of 2 pi, okay, where n is integer. Right, so then you see that the Beres phase becomes well defined and gauge independent. Right, so because it is defined modulo 2 pi anyway. Right, so then gamma for a closed loop. Okay, actually, sorry about the notation. So I agreed to call it phi geometrical. So let me stick with it. For a closed loop, geometrical phase is gauge independent. So it is a physical quantity, and it has several remarkable physical consequences, which some of which we will discuss. So, but first let me introduce a different representation of this geometrical phase, which would be explicitly gauge invariant. Okay, so how should I do that? So in the same way as you do it in electromagnetism, right? So you know that vector potential is gauge dependent, but let's say magnetic field and electric field are physical, right? So here is the same story. So you should, what you can do, you can introduce, analog of the magnetic field, right? So which would be a vector field, which would be just given by the rotor of this Beres connection, and so and this field omega is called Beres curvature. So and then I can represent, so I know that the geometrical phase for some closed loop is just the line integral of the connection, and using Stokes' theorem, I can rewrite it, as the area integral of the flux of the Beres curvature through this loop. Right, so phi. So let me call this contour C, and its boundary would be, so this whole region would be C, and its boundary would be DC. So, right, so I know that geometrical phase is the line integral like that, but I can rewrite it as a should be like that. As an area integral. And so and we can also write we can also write down omega explicitly in terms of the derivative in terms of the wave functions, right? And then you see that it's simply so Okay, so this is in terms of the wave function. So, and the way you should understand it, for example, if I have two-dimensional band, right, then there is only one component to this Berry Karoshi, which is omega 1, 2, right? And this expression just reduces to integral omega 1, 2 dkx dky, okay, over this area. So now you can from this expression you can see right away that that the Berry's curvature is gauge invariant. Yeah. Excuse me. So yes. So here I wrote it in a slightly more general way, right? Because you could define it also in higher dimensional bands, right? But we would be most interested in the case of two-dimensional band, then yes, then you should. So omega 1-1 is equal to omega 2-2 is 0, right? And omega 1-2 is non-zero. Okay. So now let's go ahead and consider a simple. Where this omega mu came from. So think about it. So think about Berry connection as some effective vector potential defined in the band, right? This omega is simply it would be like the magnetic field which corresponds to this vector potential. Okay, the advantage that it has is that it's gauge invariant. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I think you sort of answered my question.
Huh? Oh, okay, good.
Oh, I was gonna say if you write that in exterior form, it looks like a three-dimensional version of a Yang-Mills theory. So that's like your curvature two form.
Well, I mean, it's a lot simpler. You don't need to go to the Yang-Mills theory. Let's go ahead and consider an example, okay?
I have one thing that uh-huh. It's not really important. So, like originally, I saw about Berry phase is like some kind of adiabatic evolution process, such that the wave function might change in the some parameter space of the Hilbert space, and here the. Here, somehow, I'm just trying to see whether there is a slightly conceptual change. In this definition here, we kind of just consider the Brinow zone in the case space. And
uh-huh.
So I'm just saying that I didn't make any comment, but I'm just saying if I think about the usual definition of Berry phase, as I mentioned, you know, it's just mm-hmm. a parameter space.
Yes.
Or the other way, consider a Hartle Bohm phase, which is basically the real space.
Yes.
You change the parameter.
Yes.
Is whatever x mu to
uh-huh.
to this real space, and then basically with magnetic flux in
mm-hmm.
the Hartle Bohm phase. So I'm saying that here it seems like the Berry phase in this definition is specific for.
Yes. This is a very good point. You're absolutely right. Right. So of course. Nowhere here I used that k was quasi-momentum, right? Now we are, you know, we started from this example because it emerged very naturally in the context of graphene, right? And in the context of a particle scattering of disorder, right? Because when it scatters, its quasi-momentum moves around, right? And then potentially you could pick up some various phases, okay? So, but
Maybe mm-hmm. one point. Can I see adiabatic process in this derivation?
You mean where did they use
the adiabatic assumption in here?
Yes. Very good. So this is a very good question. So and so in principle, right? When I'm moving through the band, yeah. I have many block bands, right? So if I plot, let's say, energy dispersion, right? So I have usually, let's say, at least I have valence band and conduction band, right? So which are periodic. So now in all of my considerations, I was really looking at one band, right? And I was assuming that the particle, when it moves, always stays within one band. Now, of course, this is only true when the motion is adiabatic, right? And if I wanted to solve the problem honestly, right, I would say, okay, so psi of t, right, it should be some at every quasi-momentum state, I have block states in different bands, right? So I should just say something like that, right? So it should be some amplitudes which depend on time and on the number of the block band, right? Psi k of t with index n, right? Because I have n block bands. And then I should just solve the Schrödinger equation honestly with, you know, for these parameters and for a given force, right? Because I'm always dragging the particle with some force. And but then what I would find, right, is that if the force is small enough such that the motion, essentially velocity of motion through the band is much smaller than the velocity of than the group velocity of the carriers in the band, right, then you would find that a very good approximation is to say that all the alphas except for one are zero, right? Right? So this is, but this part I really sort of swept under the rug and I didn't discuss it, right? But you're right that if you really wanted to understand, let's say, if you consider some problem in which particle is moving in the band, let's say block oscillations, right? You should really make sure that this adiabaticity condition is fulfilled. Otherwise, you get band mixing and all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question.
So, so indeed, so as Druven pointed out, so this Beres phase emerges when you consider any kind of motion in the parameter space, right? When you consider a quantum system in which Hamiltonian depends on some parameter, and you slowly vary this parameter, right? And when this evolution becomes cyclic, right, such that the Hamiltonian comes back to where it started, you could pick up the geometrical phase. So let us consider actually the simple but very important example of spin 1/2. Right, so and we will see that already for such a simple system there are non-trivial Beres phases. And actually it's a very important example because you would see that in graphene reason for the occurrence of Beres phases and their structure is very similar to spin 1/2. So in this case, right, the most general Hamiltonian I can write is just the magnetic field H interacting with my spin sigma. Right, so now I should treat H as my parameter, right? And I'll find the eigenstate as a function of H, right? And then I would find the Beres curvature and the Beres connection. So first of all, let me parameterize my field H by spherical coordinates, theta and phi.
phi is usual, so, and the theta is this angle, right, and h is h can point somewhere on the sphere. So then I can find the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian, right? So for example, the ground state, it's a spinner, right, which is given by, which I can express in terms of this angles theta and phi. Okay, so this is just an eigenstate, and then I can find, right, so I have my eigenstate as a function of parameters, so now I can go ahead and find my Beri's connection and Beri's curvature. Right, so, and I will just go by the definition. So Beri's connection. In this case, instead of kx and ky, right, my coordinates are theta and phi. So I'll have the components a theta, which is given by just such a matrix element, and you can check, right? So when I take this derivative, right, you'll see that the contributions from upper and lower components cancel out. And in fact, this component of the Beri's connection is zero. Okay, and the component and the phi component is actually non-zero, right? So you can. So let's find it. Right. So what do I need to do? So this is just sine theta over 2 e to the I phi minus cosine theta over 2 I, and here I have to take the derivative with respect to phi, right? So it just becomes minus I sine theta over 2 e to the minus I phi, and when I take the derivative of the lower component, it's 0. Right, so then I get that this is sine squared theta over 2. Okay, so this is my Beri's connection. So you see that on the sphere, right, on the Bloch sphere, it's pointing, it's always pointing along the equal latitude, right? So it's only the phi component is non-zero, right? So it's pointing like this. Right? And it's getting smaller as you move closer to the poles. Right? It's sort of like a field you would create if you just take the Earth and spin it, right? Spin it along this axis. So knowing this, right, knowing this answer, we can already calculate Beri's phases for certain paths of the spin, right? So simplest path would be the following. So let's simplest path would be for me to prepare a spin, let's say, in the xy plane, right, and then just move it adiabatically, change the field such that the spin moves around the equator and comes back to the same point, right? So for a vector, right, if you consider some vector, this would be a trivial evolution. So here, but for spin 1/2, it's not, right? So phi geometric for this trajectory dc, right, becomes integral over d phi, right, a phi. So now at the equator,
theta over 2 is pi over 4, right? So this guy becomes 1 half, okay? And this integral becomes 2 pi over 2, so it's pi. Okay? So this is a non-trivial result, right? Because it tells you that when you make spin 1 half and close this trajectory, right, it comes back with an opposite phase. Right, so which is quite remarkable that such a simple system already has non-trivial Beres phase. Now, so far we found the Beres connection, but let's do the next logical step and let's find the Beres curvature, because then, right, if we know Beres curvature, then we can find the Beres phase for any path on the Bloch sphere. Right, so Beres curvature. Right, so again, I can just go by the definition and say that omega theta phi in this case is d theta a phi minus d phi a theta. Right, so it becomes d theta sine squared theta over 2. Right, so and then it becomes just sine theta over 2. Okay. Now this is nothing but the measure of integration of the sphere. Right. So if I integrate, so if I consider some path on the sphere, right, and integrate. Right. Look at the Beres phase for this path C, right? Then it would be just an integral of sine theta over 2 d phi d theta, right? Over this region C. But this is nothing but the half the solid angle, right? Which corresponds to this area. Let's call the solid angle S. So then it's half the solid angle. Okay? So which is makes sense, right? So it tells you that Beres curvature is in fact the same everywhere, right? And this dependence on the coordinate theta appeared just because of my choice of coordinates, right? Let's say if I went back to my XYZ coordinates, right, then it would be clear that the Beres curvature is the same at every point in the sphere. Okay, so and this is okay, so this you could also get this pi from here, right? Because for this trajectory that we considered for the equator trajectory. Solid angle is 2 pi, right? So the geometrical phase is pi. So you could also think about this Beres curvature in the sphere, right? So you see that the total integral of the Beres curvature over the whole manifold would be 2 pi. Okay, so and this fact is general. Right, so this essentially tells you that you can think about this field, this Beres field, as arising from a monopole, right, which is sitting here and which is creating this Beres flux. Okay, and this also tells you that in general the integral of the Beres curvature over the whole manifold should be quantized in units of 2 pi. Okay, and this quantization turns out to be very important, and it underlies several major effects, right, including quantum Hall effect, right. So in the next, our plan for the next two lectures would be to learn about quantum Hall effect and see eventually that it is the non-trivial Beres phases and the topology of the eigenstates that underlies it. Okay. So, but before we start that, so let's consider a couple of simpler examples, right? So because natural question to ask now is, okay, so we found some phase, right? So what is its physical meaning? And let me discuss two simple physical manifestations. So first let me consider the following problem. So let me consider some very small magnet, right, with magnetic moment M, which could be half integer or integer. And let me assume that the Hamiltonian is such, right, that this magnet has two degenerate ground states, one at mz equal m, and the other at mz equal minus m. Right, so either pointing up or down. But I'm not going to specify the Hamiltonian. But one could do that if it's necessary. And now let's imagine that, of course, you know, as a quantum object, right, it can tunnel quasi-classically between the two ground states. Okay, and let's imagine for some reason that the two quasi-classical tunneling trajectories are this one and this one. And again, you could come up with a Hamiltonian which does this. Right, so it's path one and path two. So then this becomes really like my standard quantum mechanical problem with a double well potential. Right, so this would be, let's say, state mz equal minus m, and this would be mz equal m, except now I have two different trajectories, right, for tunneling, one and two. And if I am to find the probability of this tunneling, right, so classically I would say that the probability is just p1 plus p2, right, classically. But quantum mechanically, I need to add the amplitudes. T1 plus T2 squared. So now you see that the phase difference that they pick up actually matters a lot, right? So if I'm dealing with a spin 1/2, or in general some half integer spin, right? You know, by symmetry, the absolute value of the tunneling amplitudes will be the same, but their geometrical phases are different, right? And clearly, their difference, right, should sum up to the Beres phase for this contour, right? So then, this answer, right, becomes very different depending on if you are dealing with a half integer or integer spin, right? So because this becomes zero, right, if c is half integer, and it interferes constructively if the spin is integer, right, so it becomes 40 squared if it's integer. Right, so and in general, you see that any problem in which there is interference between two different paths, right, which move differently in the parameter space, right, would be sensitive to the Beres phase. So second example is would be our graphene problem. Right, so example two would be going back to graphene. Now, in graphene, we saw that the wave functions, right, that the Hamiltonian is a matrix. Right? And therefore, the wave functions are spinners, right? And you could assign essentially a pseudo spin to these wave functions. Right, so really, I could think I could view this Hamiltonian as a magnetic field, right, pointing along at every point, pointing along kx and ky. Right? So I could see that okay, here it's always pointing away from the center, right? Right, this is my effective magnetic field. This is if I view, so recall that here the two spinner components are wave function amplitudes on the two sublattices, right? So the pseudo spin is really comes from the two sublattices. But this tells you that the geometrical structure of the states should be very similar to the structure of the states of spin 1/2, okay? And you see that if I take a particle, right, and move it along some contour, you see that effectively I can think about it as this magnetic field, so to say, changing right along the contour, and then my wave function would pick up some Beres phase. And you can see right away what would be the structure of Beres phases for different paths, right? So if here I have a path which encloses the zero, right? It means that the magnetic field, because this is like a vortex in the magnetic field, right? So it means that magnetic field made a full rotation, right? And this tells you that for such trajectories I get Beres phase pi, right? So trajectories enclosing the Dirac node, phase pi. But if I don't enclose it, right, then all I did in terms of my Bloch sphere right, then if I consider a trajectory, let's say like that, right, you see that in terms of my Bloch sphere, what would happen is that, okay, I moved somewhere in the equator, moved, and then I came back, right? So I did not enclose any region on the sphere, and of course the solid angle for such trajectory is zero. Right, so in this case, you see that the structure of Beres phases is very, very simple. Right, so if I enclose Dirac point, it's pi. If I didn't, it's zero. Right. So is this point clear? So and now using this simple result, right, I can go back to my problem of localization that I started with, and then clearly, right, for this quantum corrections that we talked about and for the interference between different trajectories, right, clearly the Beres phases are important. And since returning back to the initial point involves enclosing the Dirac point in the momentum space, right, it tells you that there would be Beres phase contribution to the quantum correction to conductivity. Which turns this weak localization correction to the weak anti-localization.
So if I understand correctly, for example, in that picture there with M on top, circle, 2 and 1. Mm-hmm. So we are looking at different paths. It's because we're looking at the path integral approach.
So
all different paths, and then
in principle, if you yes. If you look at the path integral approach, this would arise, right? This periphase would arise. But I considered even simpler situation. I said, let me imagine that the potential, right? Because the spin is experiencing some effective potential. Let me assume that it's such that the barrier around here is very large, right? But barrier along these two meridians is not very large. So quasi-classically, you would want to always tunnel really along these meridians, right? But this is really the simplest example when I only have two trajectories.
So do these arrows evolve according to the Schrödinger equation, or are these like?
Everything evolves according to Schrödinger equation, right? So, but there is, you're right that if you want to do it carefully, you should think about path integral, right? But then there would be, if potential is such, right, that the tunneling amplitude is small, right? There would be two main trajectories which contribute to it, right? Plus maybe some weak fluctuations around them. So let me just engineer the potential such that you mostly tunnel along these two trajectories, right?
But my question is then, if we're actually talking about the path in the world, then those trajectories, they have nothing to do with physical adiabatic change, right? They're more like the path and the path in the world don't have anything to do with Schrödinger. I mean, the specific paths don't have anything to do with evolution on the Schrödinger equation. They're just some abstract lines, and then the whole evolution itself is an evolution on the Schrödinger equation. I don't see the connection with adiabatic approximation and then path integrals.
Yes. No, that's a good point. So, well, you see, I mean, the only place where I used adiabatic approximation is that I stay in the same band, right? So, here, right? You're forced to stay in the same band by the potential, right? So here's the contribution of the trajectories which take you out of this lower band, so to say, right? Which would take you to, let's say, excited state of spin is small, right? So effectively, various phases also appear here, right? Same thing here, right? Same thing with this graphene example, because here I'm scattering, right? I'm not adiabatic, really, right? But I stay within the same band. Yeah. Makes sense, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, just to make sure I understand for the weak anti-localization of the graphene again.
Mm-hmm.
So we have one path that goes around in one direction and it picks up pi.
No. You should think about it like this, right? So you come back, so you start on some place, right? And then, you know, to come back, you should have opposite momentum, right? So it covers half the trajectory, right? And the second one, and the trajectory it interferes with covers the other half, right? So together, they cover the whole thing. Yes. Okay, so this tells you that in general, in systems where you have various phases, you should be very careful about localization. And there are many different possibilities, right? Depending on the type of disorder and so on. Okay, so we won't go into that, but this is something that, you know, I feel you guys should know about. So are there any more questions about various phases at the moment? Okay, so if not, so let's.
How do you see that if the trajectory doesn't enclose a direct point, it doesn't enclose any solid angle?
Very good. So you see in this example, right? My magnetic field is always sitting in plane, right? So imagine, so let's say this magnetic field looks like that, right? And let's say enclose some trajectory in this region. You see that the magnetic field would always have some component along this direction, right? you can deviate from it slightly, right? So maybe it's good to plot it more cleanly. So right, so this is your effective magnetic field. So and imagine an enclosed some trajectory here. Right, you see that the magnetic field is pointing somewhere on the block sphere, right? And when I enclose this trajectory, it just jitters around a little bit, right? Right. Clearly, I would never enclose the whole thing, right? You need to enclose. So magnetic field changing by 2 pi is really some kind of vortex, right? And here the only vortex you have is at the origin. Yeah, make sense?
Mm-hmm. So where does the magnetic field come from in the graphene source?
Well, this is not a true magnetic field, right? I just chose to think about quasi-momentum as the effective magnetic field, right? Which is so that I can bring it back to that simple example. Okay, so let's start talking about quantum Hall effect. And so in the remaining time, let me just formulate to use the phenomenology of it. Right? So let me tell you about experimental facts, and then we would understand them in the next lecture. So it's important to keep in mind that a lot of the phenomena we are talking about were actually discovered experimentally first, right? And quantum Hall effect is no exception. Right, and only then the theoretical understanding appeared. So ingredients for observing quantum Hall effect are very simple. So all you need is two-dimensional electron gas. 2D electron gas. With some amount of disorder, but still relatively clean. And strong quantizing magnetic field, which is perpendicular to the plane in which my 2D electron gas lives. Right, so I have some impurities, I have some electrons moving, and I have strong magnetic field. So what do I mean by strong magnetic field? So strong magnetic field means that essentially, so typical energy scale, which is set by the magnetic field, which is a cyclotron energy, which is given by Eb over mc, right? It means that this scale must be bigger than the disorder broadening. Okay, so what does it mean? It means that so omega c times disorder scattering time must be greater than 1. And qualitatively, you can think about it like that. So if you think about quasi-classical motion, right, magnetic field makes particles circle around, right? And the condition of strong field means that during one period, particle does not collide with any impurity. Right? So really my starting point should be looking at the motion of clean to dead and then adding disorder, right? as opposed to, let's say, the Drude limit, right? So Drude limit would be weak magnetic field, right? When omega c tau is much less than 1, which tells you that if you consider motion of an electron, right? It bends slightly by the magnetic field and it scatters, it bends a little more, and so on, right? So which is quite different, because here I'm mostly dealing with a plane wave, right, which scatters and gets a bit deflected with magnetic field. So really I'm staying quasi-classical, while here really this is a strong quantum limit, right? So in which magnetic field would lead to the formation of Landau levels. So now essence of quantum Hall effect is the following. So let us do something simple and let us measure sigma xx and sigma xy, right, just the longitudinal and Hall conductivity as a function of the carrier density. Right? So I'm going to change the density in my sample at a given field. And I'm going to study how my transport coefficients behave. So of course, if the field is weak, then nothing remarkable happens. So you have some Drude conductivity and some small Hall conductivity. But as you go to this quantum limit, then the behavior changes completely. So first of all, you find that sigma xx, so sigma xx is going to be white and sigma xy is going to be blue. So first of all, you find that sigma xx becomes small, and then there are big regions where it vanishes, right? And then in between, it shows some peaks like that, and so on. Okay. Right. So which is quite surprising. At these peak values are of the order of v squared over h. Sigma xy, right? The Hall conductivity does something very interesting as well. So it shows a staircase where there are steps and there are broad plateaus, right, of the quantized conductivity, which coincide with the zeros of sigma xy. Now, even more remarkable fact is that the conductivity at these plateaus, sigma xy, is quantized at the plateaus. At values which are integer multiples of e squared over h to a great precision, right? So n is integer to a precision in best samples to degree of 10 to the minus 10. Okay, so it's really the Hall conductivity at this plateaus depends only on the fundamental constant, nothing else. So now this is integer quantum Hall effect. But turns out this is not even the end of the story. So it turns out as your sample gets cleaner and magnetic field gets even stronger, then you also see that these steps, right, they start breaking into smaller plateaus. Right? And you can see, you know, tens of little plateaus in between, right? So you find that so if the even stronger field or cleaner samples, fractional plateaus. Some rational number quantized now at rational number 10 to the squared over h, and this is the fractional quantum Hall effect. So This was really striking observation, and so both of these things were first discovered experimentally as well, right? And in the next lectures, we will understand the underlying mechanism, and we'll see that actually there are many very important concepts at play here. So we'll see that this effect, that the integer quantum Hall effect, is essentially a single particle phenomenon, and its origin lies in the various phases and the topology of the Landau bands, right? But then we would also see that the origin of the fractional quantum Hall effect is very different, right? So that here, electron interactions are important, and these fractional quantum Hall states are actually very unusual correlated liquids with fractional excitations, you know, anionic statistics, and so on. Okay, so which I find quite remarkable, right? So if you just look at the transport coefficient, they look deceptively similar, right? But in fact, turns out that the physics is very different. Okay, so I will leave you with this phenomenology today, and tomorrow we'll start understanding it.